The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome to our Monday afternoon California time Space Show program. Great to be here. Thank you all for joining us. A couple of very, very quick announcements, and then on to Jeff Bell. So for those of you who would like to call and talk with Dr. Bell, that phone number is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Let it ring until it can be answered, and we'll bring it up on the air and bring you up on the air as soon as possible. Email is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And do remember that we're trademarked, copyrighted, and all of that good stuff. So no commercial usage of the shows, no editing of the programs like for YouTube channels or anything like that. And again, please, no written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. And then check out our newsletter, thespaceshow.com, because our comprehensive newsletter is there. It has all of the details of the week's programming and the guest bios, and this is where we make announcements that something has to change, for example. But you can also subscribe to the very short and easy-to-do email newsletter. It goes out early Monday morning. And just send your request to drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website, or you can download these shows. They're all there going back to 2001, and I believe the program today with Dr. Bell is number 1,717. So every one of them is there. There are a few of them are taken off air for purposes that I don't disclose, but the most of them are there, and you can easily get them. Remember, we do podcast, and Andrew over at gigadial.net does do our podcasting for us. We're in iTunes and Podcast Alley, astrospacenow.com, yastro.com, and Zune. And check us out if you have any questions, and we'll do our best to help you. We don't always succeed, but we do respond, and we'll give it our best effort. On our website, there's a store. You'll see it up at the top called Space Show Gear. But above all, the big button there, support the Space Show. We are a nonprofit 501c3, and we live because some of you do support us. And thank you very much. The Space Show is a very costly program using a lot of technology to produce, especially on the webinar side. And your support is greatly appreciated and vital to our health. And this year we're doing thank you gifts for people, and the first one we started out doing for gifts of $50 or so is a Space Show custom-made lapel pin that we will send you if you donate in that category. More gifts to be announced and to be put forth later this year. And then the last little comment I want to remind everybody about is that we are brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation. And they do promote cooperative solutions for space security. You can get a lot more information about the great work that they do by visiting their website, secureworldfoundation.org. And they are the sponsors of our webinar program, of which we have more in process, and we're going to be doing many more this year. And we're very, very thankful to Secure World. And that brings me to our show today. Dr. Bell is back with us from Hawaii. And Jeff has his BS, and some people say he's all BS, right, Jeff? But I guess that's appropriate. He's got his BS in physics and astronomy from the University of Michigan. He has an MS in astronomy from the University of Hawaii, and his PhD is also in astronomy from the University of Hawaii. From 84 to 2000, He was a professor of planetary science at the Hawaii Institute of Geophysics at the University of Hawaii. He conducted research on mineralogical composition of asteroids from visible and IR reflection spectroscopy. He was a science team member, Comet Rendezvous, asteroid flyby spacecraft, and he was at one time the PI on several space mission proposals. Since 2003, Jeff has been writing semi-regular opinion columns on space policy and technology for the website spacedaily.com, and he brings a more skeptical and realistic perspective to the pro-space community, and he has been at least on once annually, many times more than that, on the space show since about 2002, 2003, driving all the space cadets eternally crazy because of his realism and his frank assessment of what's happening in cadet land. Jeff, welcome back. How are you?
Oh, pretty good, pretty good.
Boy, lots of stuff has been happening in cadet land, too, since you were last on the show.
Yeah, there's been a lot of scary stuff going on in space. The scariest stuff has been going on in Russia, just kind of unusual. I'm starting to get very concerned about what's going on over there.
Well, we're dependent upon them for our rides to the space station.
And we've just had a Progress failure a while back, and we've had a Soyuz failure where the testing crew managed to blow it up in pressure testing. And, that's...
So what's happening? Why are they having so many problems over the past year and a half?
Well, if you listen to experts over there, including this guy, General Premirov, their new boss at Roscosmos, the problem is basically one of personnel. For a long time after, basically during the 1990s, they had virtually no money to run space programs over there, and a lot of people who died or retired weren't replaced because there was no money to replace them. And in the last 10 years, they've actually, been able to hire new people, but they're most of these various organizations either are direct state government organizations or they're government-owned corporations. Very few of these organizations you read about are really real companies, real joint stock companies. OAO is the abbreviation they use over there for the real corporations. But most of them are partly or entirely government-owned. And they still have all the old Soviet problems, plus a whole bunch of new ones which have arisen. And the main one is just a shortage of qualified personnel. I mean, I read on a Russian blog that people at Lavochkin, a company that built Phobos Grunt, computer programs, software engineers were being paid like one-third what they could make at other organizations in Moscow, really private organizations like banks or oil companies. You can see right there what the problem is.
Well, is that because the it's a government space program, or are all these companies private and they don't have the money to pay higher wages?
Well, money comes from the government. I mean, even in our space program, right?
Right.
Except for, a few billionaires who are putting in their own money into their own little companies. Even a really private organization gets all of its income from contracts from various government agencies that fly spacecraft. And there just was essentially no money available in the 1990s for anything except the highest priority items. And not just in space, but in defense and everything else. It was basically a lost decade in Russia. Even today, there are just lots of similarities with the Russian era. I've just been reading the memoirs of Boris Chertok, who was a top engineer and administrator for Korolev's design bureau back in the golden age of Soviet space. And reading his memoirs, which are not really intended to be all that critical, you can see that they had very serious problems even then with management and systems engineering. And I mean, our whole vision of the Soviet program in the 60s and 70s was very far from the truth, and that's even true in formerly secret intelligence documents. We didn't really have a very good idea of how things were run over there and how screwed up they really were. I mean, at least today you have Roscosmos, which is a direct equivalent to NASA. They do have a civilian space agency. There's nothing like that during the Soviet period. If you read a big history book about it, they all have a chart that purports to show who controlled what and who did what in the Soviet space program, you know, circa 1965. And it's just an unbelievable, tangle. Nobody seemed to be really in charge of anything.
Well, what does it take to, by the way, listeners, I have the phone disconnected so Jeff can put out some of his thoughts, and I'll tell you when I'm going to connect it again. But what are they able to do to get their manufacturing and these processes under control? I'm sure they're not intentionally wanting to have all these accidents and lost vehicles.
Well, I have to have a post-Soviet space industry, which means they have to have a post Soviet government, which means they'd have to have a post-Soviet electorate that would be willing to vote the current the current mafia out, and they'd have to have security troops who would be willing to not shoot demonstrators and protesters. And for a long time, I've been waiting for for all those things to appear, and it looks like now finally that some of those things might be appearing. But the situation now is, it's just, I was actually involved with the Soviet space mission Phobos 88 during the perestroika period, and I met some of the top level Soviet science engineers that were working on that program. And of course, it was a dismal failure. It was the first big Soviet failure after a long run of successful missions to Venus and even Halley's Comet.
Was that because of your involvement?
No. In fact, I'm still trying to figure out exactly what went wrong in 1988. I think the basic problem. Well, I know the basic problem is the same. It's the current Phobos grunt failure. The mission is just far too ambitious and far too complicated to be done by the number of personnel and the amount of money they have allocated to it. And the same thing happened with the Mars 96 mission, which was between those two Phobos failures. It actually failed during launch because of an upper stage failure. The spacecraft never got a chance to operate, but just by looking at it in the book, you can see that, again, it was just far too complicated. I mean, this is a persistent problem in space travel, unmanned space travel especially, is that engineers get very overambitious. They have a couple of successes. They think they can do it all, that they're supermen, and they design and build a mission which is simply too complicated, has too many new parts, new computer programs that can't be properly tested and debugged in the time available. A mission like that right now on the way to Mars.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Curiosity and their landing. Does that concern you?
The landing technique, it's crammed with instruments, many of which do not need to move around on a rover, right? I mean, it's totally unnecessarily heavy, besides which their scientists are sending it to the wrong place on Mars, where they're not going to find sedimentary rocks like they claim they are. But in working on the Phobos 88 mission, I got the impression that these people were incompetent. I mean, these were people who had been working on Soviet missions and building instruments for like 20 years. They'd been on a whole series of these Venus missions. And I was totally unimpressed by them. You know, I was not impressed by a lot of American planetary scientists at that time. But on our side, we had a pretty good system for, you know, screening the B team out of actually participating in space missions. So after I'd gone to a couple conferences with these guys, I asked some American Venus experts, who I'd never talked to before, because I never had any real interest in Venus. I said, you know, are these really the guys who, you know, provided all this data from Venus and, you know, actually had a spacecraft work in that tremendous heat environment? And they said, well, we can't talk about the engineers because we never meet them, but we don't believe any of the Soviet Venus data from all those successful missions. The scientific instruments and their calibration we regard as highly dubious.
Really? I never heard that before.
Well, it's been a long time, so I can say it now, but they said, why did we spend all that money on the Pioneer Venus mission, which basically repeated all the measurements that the Soviets had made? And I said, gee, that never occurred to me before. I thought it was just a typical typical NASA money-wasting pork barrel project.
Well, did it get different data than what the Russians got?
Yeah, in many cases it was different. And nowadays, a lot of the Russian data from those missions is just forgotten. I mean, of course, Pioneer Venus has been so long, but since there hasn't been a real Venus mission since then, I guess you'd probably still be stuck with that data. But, you know, the impression I got was that, at least in the perestroika area, when things were already starting to collapse in the Soviet Union, I mean, this didn't suddenly happen, you know, when communism collapsed, but even during the Gorbachev period, it was clear that, you know, things were grinding to a halt, the machine wasn't working properly anymore, you know, they had a severe problem, and their space program always had a large propaganda element to it. And even the people who had access to the real secret information, in which there was a huge amount about the Soviet program, didn't quite realize how it was. I mean, they were mirror imaging our space program. They assumed that there was the existence of some NASA-like organization in secret that was running it all. They made a lot of mirror imaging assumptions about the, and the people on the outside at the time, if you read like unclassified books about the Soviet program, they're really hilarious to read today. But it's clear that we have a worse problem today. In the last year and a half, they've had a whole string of failures, and at first I was willing to write them off as a statistical fluke. I mean, every program, every booster has a rash of random failures that just happen to cluster together because of statistics. But, you know, now I think we have a real problem there, right? I mean, this Soyuz failure, which everyone seems to be ignoring, has severely disrupted the schedule for crew exchange on ISS.
Well, they blew the thing up.
Well, and not only did they burst a weld on it, apparently the burst damaged the hydrogen peroxide control system that maneuvers the descent module during reentry.
Uh-huh.
And you don't want to play around with any damaged piping with hydrogen peroxide because it'll spoil your whole day if it gets loose. So they've taken that whole spacecraft off to the junk room, and they're going to hurriedly prepare the next one on the production line for the next ISS mission. And they can't do that many times until they're pushed up against the wall. There's also an interesting story that was on Anatoly Zak's website, but it's apparently been taken down now, that two people involved in that explosion have already died mysteriously.
Is that credible?
Well, I don't know. One guy apparently who was, you know, ordered to write a report on this failure, even though he claimed he was not present on that day. He was a little sick that day. Right after this painful interview with his boss, he fell down and died of a heart attack right by the main gate of the Lachkin factory.
I mean, that sounds unusual.
Well, they have a lot of very old people working in that program, again, because of this hiring gap. You see this at American corporations and at NASA, too, is that there's a lot of graybeards left over from the Cold War and a lot fewer people have been hired since then. But this is a serious situation because we've made ourselves completely dependent on
the Russian hardware.
Well, and this happened long before the space shuttle went out of action too. I mean, the space shuttle, for some inexplicable reason, can't perform the lifeboat function. It can't stay up at the space station with the crew it's brought up and, stand by for them. It had a maximum time in space of 2 weeks because of, various systems that would decay and deteriorate in a longer time. And Soyuz, because of its inherent design, could easily qualify for 6 months in space, docked at the station. So if to have a six-man crew up there, you need to have two Soyuz spacecraft in working order docked to the station at all time in case there's a disaster, everybody needs to come home. And now with no shuttle and no Dragon and no Orion, that we're also dependent on Soyuz for the crew exchange function completely. So, this is a serious situation. I mean, to my knowledge, nothing like this testing accident has ever happened before in the Soyuz program.
Well, do you think that the U.S. in a relatively few more years, I don't know, 2 years maybe or more, will have at least one way to get up to the station with people, Dragon or something?
Well, gee, what's happening with Dragon? What's happening with Falcon?
Well, I know it was delayed, but...
We even launched a test booster in a year. Over a year.
My understanding is the latest delay is around the software that controls the rendezvous with the space station.
Yeah, NASA is very touchy about that.
I would think so.
Especially after that incident where a Progress vehicle collided with Mir, the Soviet space station. They're very touchy about people coming close to the station, under computer control.
Yeah. Listeners, I have opened up the line if you want to call and talk to Jeff, 866-687-7223. So what do you hear through your sources on the SpaceX delays? Because I just hear the kind of mainstream, stuff. I read the SpaceX announcements when they come out.
I don't have any sources there, but what I do see is a continuous stream of press releases from SpaceX about new projects which they're undertaking. There have been, during that year in which no Falcon boosters were launched and no Dragon spacecraft were launched, SpaceX has announced a whole variety of new initiatives, which I think are just distracting them from, what should be their main program. We've had Red Dragon, this crazy idea of landing on Mars with the Dragon capsule, which is designed for Earth's atmosphere and not for Mars. We've had this idea of converting Falcon 9 into a flyback booster and having it fly back to the Cape and land on a little pad. We've had, what's it called, Strato launch. Build the world's most giant airplane and drop giant boosters from it. I mean, I think last time I explained how most of these ideas, just don't pass technical inspection. But whether they succeed or not, they're, distracting SpaceX and Elon, who is, I gather pretty much the sole manager and systems engineer there. They're distracting the company and Elon from what should be their two most important projects, Falcon and Dragon. he has a real opportunity here to, you know, become the great white knight who rides in and saves the American manned space program, and it seems to me that he's blowing it by being distracted by all these other blue sky programs.
Well, that's come up a lot on the space show, but of course I have no information on it. I mean, Gwen is the CEO of the company and probably runs the day-to-day stuff of the company. They're growing. They're busy. I went and toured them. Have I talked to you since I toured them in October or September?
I don't
remember when you were last on, but it's very impressive to go into their Hawthorne plant. And, you know, the people are inspired and motivated. You know, if I were a young guy and I were an engineer, I mean, it's a world for aerospace engineers or mechanical engineers. It's not a business guy world. I mean, I would die to work at SpaceX.
They have hired a lot of extremely good people. I was just reading in the alumni newsletter from my old alma mater, University of Michigan, that of their top engineering graduates in the last 10 years, five are now working at SpaceX.
I wouldn't doubt it. Everybody I know who goes there absolutely loves it. And having toured them twice, once in their old facility and in Hawthorne, I absolutely can understand that.
But the question remains, you know, why has nothing happened for a year?
I can't answer that, but you have a caller on hold who maybe can answer that. Do you want to take the call?
Sure.
Hi, caller. Who are you?
Hi, it's John from Jersey City.
So can you answer his SpaceX questions?
Well, that wasn't what I called in about, but yes, I have a suggestion anyway. I recently read, I think it might have been part of the announcement at the recent FAA conference. I think it was Garrett Reisman, said something about how the Hawthorne facility was being converted over the past year from a prototyping shop to a production shop. And so, you know, I think to some extent they may be focusing on regularizing their operations and gearing up for, you know, a significant launch tempo. I think the other reason they might not have launched is the sensitivity that the commercial crew has politically, and their fear is if they are launching frequently, it may be that some sort of issue with one of those launches might cause a political firestorm, and they'd rather delay and take the chance on the COPS flights going smoothly. The COPS flights.
Yeah, I can understand them being terrified about their enemies swooping down on them in the case of an accident. But you cannot run a development program like that without having some accidents.
Right, but the timing would be the consideration.
Well, I mean,
when is the time going to be right that they can tolerate a failure?
I don't know, but there are people in Congress who would absolutely love to yank the commercial crew funding from the project and kill these guys and all the commercial crew people. There is no doubt about that.
Yeah, well, all the existing contractors have an army of lobbyists and bribes are flowing freely. I mean, every congressman who has a traditional contractor plant in their district has been fighting this whole COTS program tooth and nail. But now by not flying, they give these opponents another hammer to beat SpaceX with. You know?
Yeah, but I think it's a smaller hammer than would they'd have in their hands if there was some sort of issue with the SpaceX launch.
And they actually had a failed launch.
If they can push it off until this current budgeting cycle is complete and the CI cap or this next round of funding is over, they've at least got a shot of the program continuing for that much longer.
Yeah, well, that makes good political sense. I'm not sure I like your idea of them converting their factory from prototyping to production. I mean, that implies that they have a design that's fixed and they can build tooling that won't have to be reworked again.
Well, I mean, I think I read that on Hobby Space today, actually, that this was one of the things, or it might have been Parabolic Arc, that this was one of the things that Garrett Reisman was talking about at the FAA conference. You know, so that's not something, that's not speculation on my part. I actually read it as something that a SpaceX employee said.
I just think it sounds like it's too early to commit to mass production, unless they're absolutely sure that they don't need any major design changes before they start rolling them out like sausages, in the words of Nikita Khrushchev.
John, what was the reason you called in for?
So I was calling about the previous discussion on the Russian space program. The first, before I ask the main question that I had, I wanted to clarify, are you seeing issues with just the Russian space program or also with the Russian aerospace industry?
Well, basically in Russia there's a space industry which is separate from the aircraft industry. Right, there's no aerospace industry there. There are specific factories and design bureaus which used to do aircraft work and were forced by Khrushchev to switch over to working for rockets, military missiles, and space missions. And, I mean, the head of Roscosmos has said this, that this is a systemic problem throughout the rocket and space industry. You can see it if you look at their military missile program, which is proceeding at a glacial pace. I mean, I just read this ridiculous story in the New York Times that Putin has promised to build 40 ICBMs a year for the next 10 years, along with a whole other bunch of stuff that's supposed to happen to rebuild their military. Well, in recent years, they've been building on the order of 6 ICBMs a year, right? In fact, a while back, Russian Rocket Force had announcing that one of their regiments had upgraded from 6 missiles to 9 missiles, right? I mean, this is the rate at which their rocket industry is producing ICBMs for the highest priority defense program that they have. So it's a... Yeah, it's a systemic problem in all parts of their industry.
Okay, so that kind of plays into the real question that I had, and that is if they are really experiencing deep systemic problems, this is likely to lead to further failures, further issues, and a loss of confidence in the commercial market. And they currently are the leader in commercial launches. What it makes me wonder is, what will the commercial market look like a few years down the road if this continues? Who's going to get the market share that they currently have?
Well, what are the competitors? There's China, which is basically off limits because of ITAR.
Well, but they're not commercial anyway.
Well, at one time they were making commercial launches. Until a couple of very expensive commsats were flown into the ground.
I mean, I think the U.S. is the only one really pursuing a commercial industry as a set of goals, right?
Don't you have, I mean, doesn't India launch some? And
Well, they don't have the capabilities, though, John, that either Russia or United States have, and that were the rocket capacity, or of even Ariane, which, despite being commercial...
Well, the competitors are Ariane Space.
Yeah, and they've never turned a profit ever, despite being the most successful rocket in the world.
Well, they get huge subsidies from the French government and ESA also, right? I mean, I'm using commercial in a very loose term here. I think you are. I hope you are, too. Of, you know, when I have a CompSat, who are the bidders to launch it, right?
Right.
Well, yeah, ULA is commercial, and... Ariane is commercial in India, but their payloads are smaller. And you can do a commercial on China, but not too many people want to do it, although they're developing the Long March 5.
So what it sounds to me like is that you're thinking that it's going to be ULA and SpaceX.
Well, ULA is so bloody expensive, it's hard to know how they would do in a truly international competitive environment. And most of their, and I just don't know. They're really high cost, but then so is Ariane. Huh?
Commercial, so-called commercial industry depends entirely upon the amount of subsidies you get from your government. All right. ULA was launching things pretty cheap back when they had most of their overhead covered by the NASA shuttle program, right?
Correct.
There's been a huge increase in the cost of subsystems like engines and guidance systems.
Yeah, they've gone up dramatically.
Right, that's because, well, Rocketdyne, let's take the engines, right? Rocketdyne has Rocketdyne, Pratt & Whitney now, has a huge overhead, which they mostly bill to NASA because NASA's cost analysis and oversight is far worse than that of the Air Force, right? So they bid all of their extra vice presidents and vice presidents' relatives, you know, working in the mailroom, all the unnecessary overhead was billed to the shuttle program, right? Because NASA would never object to it. Well, when shuttle was closed down and Rocketdyne lost those huge contracts for constantly rebuilding and upgrading the space shuttle engines, they had to bill all that overhead to the Air Force, right? And to the ULA program. And suddenly the cost of both ULA boosters went through the roof because of this overhead transfer. Now, the government should go to Rocketdyne and all the other contractors and say, look, you know, the shuttle program is no more. You should fire all the people who were working on the shuttle program and a proportional share of the overhead in your company, right? Or we won't do business with you anymore. But they can't do that because there's nobody else who could take over, right? I mean, they're committed to Delta and Atlas. Another example here is the Delta II program, which has always been kind of out of the mainstream at ULA. The Delta II program had a big subsidy from the Air Force for the GPS program. Not only did they get many orders for launches for GPS satellites, but they also had a requirement which they paid for to maintain a booster and a GPS satellite on 60-day readiness at the Cape to replace any GPS satellite that went dead. But the Air Force has switched away to bigger boosters for GPS. That huge market was lost. That huge launch on need subsidy was lost. The costs of Delta II have gone way up to the point where it's not attractive anymore to any commercial vendors or to NASA that used to buy a few Delta IIs every year for small science missions.
But it's being shut down now.
Well, it's being shut down because at the new non-subsidized cost basis, right, the main customer, NASA, can't afford it. Right. And the same thing is true with Ariane and the Chinese program, of course, and I'm not quite so sure about sea launch and land launch, which are, you know, basically Ukrainian-based things, or the Russian program. I mean, what's really commercial over there? In Putin's Russia, you can never take any figure for granted. I mean, you know, how much government subsidy is there for these commercial launches in Russia?
But it may not matter if they're perceived as having reliability problems.
Yes, well, the satellites cost $1 billion each, the latest CONSATs, and they want high reliability. And there's been, in addition to the progress in Soyuz accidents I mentioned, there's been a series of failures with commercial CompSat launches or Russian military launches over there. So
I don't want to monopolize the line, so if I could, I'd just like to give you a little food for thought and then drop off.
Mm-hmm.
So on the subject of ULA and them being quite expensive in recent years, one of the things that's changing is they have the potential to significantly boost the flight rate of the Atlas V. Three of the commercial crew providers will be using it. And so if they're selected, if one or two of those is selected for commercial crew, this will boost the flight rate of the Atlas V. In addition to that, the military is attempting to do a block buy. And so what I'm... Just some food for thought is what happens if their flight rates go up significantly over the next 5 years or so, and at the same time the Russian program is winding down. Potentially this could lead to low enough launch costs and enough market opportunity for ULA to start capturing international market share.
It's clear that there are too many booster programs chasing too few commercial payloads. And I've thought for years that the Air Force's intention over the long term was to phase out Atlas V.
All right. Well, John,
are you still there?
Yes.
The other idea to what you just said is that ULA could look at the environment and. To what degree do they really have a motive to lower the launch cost if they're the reliable one that people are going to flock to? How much money do they want to leave on the table by lowering launch costs? And will they get new customers or will they just be given a break to existing customers? So it's not a given that what you said would result in them lowering launch prices. They may feel that they, you know, have such a lock on a narrowly defined market that there's no reason to really do much to lower launch prices.
Well, I think you may well be right there.
We just don't know.
A lot depends on SpaceX and whether...
Absolutely. They're the wild card.
Yeah, if they develop a reputation for reliability and low cost, I think this is going to prompt changes.
And then it's a different ballgame. Absolutely.
Well, I think the Air Force has put a lot of money into SpaceX, and I think they're long-term goal has been for a long time to replace Atlas V or Delta IV, which are now built by the same company in the same factory in Alabama, to replace one of those boosters with a really independent new space. And I think that's going to be Falcon. I think either Delta IV or Atlas V is going to be scrapped in favor of Falcon, as soon as Falcon has demonstrated reliability and acceptable cost.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Okay, John, thank you very much. Listeners, you can use the line. It's free and clear, 1-866-687-7223. Do you see a resolution of the Russian problems, or do you think they're going to be persistent and with us for a long time?
Well, let's just look at the Phobos grunt story, right?
Okay.
Here at RussianSpaceWeb.com, they have a table of bogus explanations provided for the Phobos grunt failure by various Russian official sources, right? In November, a retired Russian lieutenant general, formerly in charge of the 3rd Early Warning Army, which is the organization that tells them when we're attacking them with missiles.
Now, I'm on their website. Where do I go to find this list?
Oh, it's information on Phobos grunt failure emerges.
Okay.
That's the name of the page.
Okay. Go ahead.
And he said that the vehicle was knocked down by interference from some big American radar in Alaska, and many people assume he meant the HAARP facility, but I think he really meant one of the big Air Force radars up there, either the Coberdane out at Shemya or the missile warning radar at Clear near Fairbanks, because those radars are transmitting all the time at very high power. The problem is that Phobos was never above the horizon from Alaska. Then in January, there was another wave of claims that it was a despicable Yankee trick. The head of Roscosmos, General Primov, and the deputy prime minister, his name I forget, both claimed it had to be a diabolical act by foreign military organizations, by which, of course, they meant the U.S. Some of the actual investigating commission members blamed U.S. radars in the Marshall Islands, by which I think they meant the big radars on Roy Namur in the Kwajalein test area. And those radars do send powerful signals at satellites. They even take images of satellites out in geosynchronous orbit. But there's no record of any satellite being knocked down by radar interference. I mean, you know, just the random train of pulses is just not going to cause a problem. In fact, Lavochkin has actually run tests of this radar interference theory on their shot model of Phobos Grunt, and they say it's totally impossible. Right, then a few days later, the commission blamed solar flares interfering with the electronics, but then they forgot to check if there was a solar flare at the time, and then, well, of course there wasn't. Then the investigating commission, a few days after that, decided it was cosmic rays that knocked out these two CPU chips that failed simultaneously on the craft.
How far down the list do you go until you get to vodka?
Well, I mean, this is a deep-seated problem in Russia, deep-seated xenophobia and a need to blame all problems on foreigners. Right?
Uh-huh.
And we Americans make the ideal foreigners to blame because we really are pretty powerful and have a whole bunch of secret space programs running on in the black budget that conceivably could do this kind of stuff. Right? Now, I have my own conspiracy theory, which I'm surprised that nobody in Russia has thought up. I think this may be the official secret conspiracy theory, which is that everybody knows that all the space powers are working on the business of knocking out enemy satellites through soft means, deniable means. Right?
Yeah, plausible deniability.
Slip in a phony command that turns off the attitude control system, or turns off all the receivers, or overpressurizes the tanks and causes them to burst. To do that, you have to know the enemy's command system. You need to break their whatever encryption they're using on their uplink commands. you have to send the signal up from a place where some antenna on the satellite is looking at. Right? Almost all satellites have an omnidirectional antenna that is the backup emergency antenna. Right? If the high gain antenna that's pointing towards the command site at, say, Alice Springs or Denver, right, where our command sites are, that's hard to break into. You'd have to take, a 70-meter dish and move it to Denver or the outback near Alice Springs, and, you know, border guards would notice that kind of thing. You have to work through the emergency omnidirectional antenna, right? And this system, it has to look in all directions in case the spacecraft loses attitude control. It has to be working all the time, because at any time you can have a glitch in the main command system and need to access the emergency system, send up emergency command. You can't make the encryption for this emergency system too difficult, right? Because you want to format these commands and send them up really quickly if there's an emergency. So that system is conceivably penetratable by a strong signal from the ground or even another spacecraft. Right. That's for GEO satellites. For low Earth orbit satellites, it's a little more difficult. You'd have to, you know, have a powerful antenna that tracked it, right? Well, right after Phobos Grunt was launched, after it went into orbit and was sending back telemetry to the station at Galenki near Vladivostok, it passed over one of the main national security satellite tracking bases at Misawa in Japan. I'm looking at it right now on Wikimapia. Misawa Security Operations Center. All right, it's got 19 big golf ball radomes housing giant satellite tracking dishes. So, I've developed this program that supposedly can turn off Russian or Chinese satellites. We'll test it on our satellite, of course, but that's not really a very convincing test. You got to test it on somebody else's satellite in order to get funding to make it an operational system and have people standing by, you know, somewhere to do this in case it's necessary. So Phobos Grunt is the ideal satellite to test this system on, right? Everybody knows it's going to fail, right? Anatoly Zak's website, you know, explained in great detail why it was certain to fail before it was even launched. So, everybody will expect it to fail. Nobody will be able to figure out exactly why it failed. It's the obvious thing to test it on. So, when Phobos Grunt is flying overhead, and just after it passes over the horizon from Siberia, you've got a few minutes there to send up your phony commands and screw up the spacecraft. Now, I don't believe this theory, but I'm sure that people in Russia who, you know, have worked in their military satellite program and have worried about this capability for many years, you know, it's easy to see how they would immediately blame it on American interference, because Perumov, the head of Roscosmos, has been the former head of their space forces. He spent years in charge of military procurement. He's worried about all these issues, and I'm sure that he's seen many secret documents which grossly exaggerate the Americans' capability to do this, because all intelligence documents grossly exaggerate the other side's capability. You can easily understand from Russian history and from real experience in running satellites how high-ranking people over there would immediately suspect it was some kind of American interference. So they may just not be making a crazy defense and trying to divert the blame. You know, they might actually think this. Might not be just a propaganda statement. I could easily see how they could take this very seriously.
Is there any way anything like that could be confirmed?
Not by me, and if no. I mean, this is just the idea I think up here by looking at where tracking stations are on the internet, not on Google Earth. But it's just a natural thing for them to suspect, and it fits right into their national xenophobia and paranoia. Because it was a big embarrassment for them. This project was highly touted as the rebirth of Russian planetary exploration. And they had plans to use this basic spacecraft bus for like a dozen more spacecraft. There was, you know, Luna Glob and Luna Resource and Venera D. You look at the Lavochkin website, they have like a whole variety of spacecraft that were supposed to be based on this same new spacecraft bus. So, you know, unless they find out the real answer here, which, you know, I mean, the real answer is there was just inadequate money, inadequate testing time for such an unbelievably complicated spacecraft. I mean, you look at every spacecraft failure, and usually somewhere in the report, inadequate testing is the culprit.
So
that Mars polar lander
that
failed because, you know, Lockheed Martin requested extra time and money to thoroughly test it out, And Dan Golden wouldn't give it to him. You know, he didn't realize, he didn't accept that, of course, the original estimate was lowballed, like all NASA cost estimates are, and they needed extra money to, you know, properly test out the thing before it was launched. Because Golden was crazy, he didn't give him the extra money, and so the spacecraft failed. And that's clearly the case here. I mean, the spacecraft was just too ambitious for the amount of money and time that was allocated. I mean, one excuse I've heard that they'd already delayed launch 2 years to the next Mars window, and if they delayed it another 2 years to allow for adequate testing, the guaranteed shelf life of some of the components would have expired before the end of the mission in Mars. I mean, I worked on a bunch of proposals for the same mission, sample return from Phobos. And, you know, the first thing we decided is that the mission has to be as simple as possible. It has to do nothing except return the sample. It's going to have, like, the minimum of instruments you need to pick the spot and document the site you take the sample from. You know, it's not going to have any instruments pointed at Mars or any solar astronomy instruments or galactic astronomy instruments, you know, both of which they had on Phobos Grunt. It's not going to try to satisfy every scientific group in the world. It's just going to do this one narrow task and bring back dirt from Phobos. And missions designed in that philosophy usually work, and the ones that are designed on this university-in-a-box philosophy of, like, taking on every instrument that's lying around in somebody's lab in the whole world, those missions don't have a good track record because they're too complicated. The software and the wiring harness and everything just gets absurdly complicated.
Well, we now have James Webb, which is extremely complicated, cost overruns, and we've got Curiosity's landing, which is unbelievable. Do you think that the U.S. is up to it with these kinds of missions?
Well, it happens all the time. This has been a constant trend in spacecraft design. If you let the engineers off their leash, let them out of their kennel and let them run wild, they will produce a monstrosity like this. Because, you know, that's what they want to do. They all want to produce the Mona Lisa, not a cartoon strip, right? I mean, every artist has that desire to to make the Mona Lisa, and engineers are really artists. They have to be kept under control. And JPL, unfortunately, the standard control mechanisms that operate don't really work there. Ever since they were given a monopoly on the Mars program and they were freed from normal scientific peer review, which happened some years ago, ever since then, the missions have been getting more and more complicated. And I mean, and you can pretty much predict. There's a model that the Aerospace Corporation has evolved that allows them to predict whether a mission will fail or not. Right? It was published in Aviation Week some years ago. They have a computer equation that measures the complexity of the mission. If you plot the mission complexity on one axis and the money available and time available on another axis, there's a sharp division between missions that worked and missions that failed. And, I don't know where Curiosity plots in that diagram, but I'm sure somebody at Aerospace has made that plot. Probably been forbidden from publishing it.
We're an hour into the program. How about taking our first break?
Yeah, I think I need one.
I think we do, too. Listeners, we'll be back in 3 minutes. If we don't come back, I guess the Putin Secret Service has nailed Jeff somehow. Maybe vaporized you. What do you think? Can they do that?
Well, we have a lot of black helicopter activity over my neighborhood.
Are they Russian or U.S.?
No, I found out who they are when the School of Education burned down a few blocks down the street from me.
Who were they?
Ago. Well, a horde of black helicopters came around and pointed little turrets at the fire, and I realized these are all from local TV stations. They've all agreed to paint their helicopters black for some reason.
But the TV stations are doing black
helicopters. TV stations run the black helicopters.
Well, the power of the media is growing.
That's very appropriate.
Back in 3 minutes, everyone.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, listeners, and this is our Monday Space Show program, and this is the second segment. Our guest today, Dr. Jeff Bell, it is President's Day. It's part of a holiday weekend, so a good holiday to all of you. And also, 50 years ago, John Glenn took the United States into space, and we might talk about that in this segment, but Jeff, what I need to know is, should I go online and see if I can find a flag with 51 stars in it? Should I be ordering that pretty soon?
Yes, you're talking about the lunar statehood proposal.
From Commander Newt.
Space Commander Newt. Yeah, well, I mean, this is classic Newt, right? You know, you start out with an idea that's like, you know, very avant-garde and, you know, extreme to start with, and then you run it into the ground, right? You run wild with it. I mean, Newt has always had this problem that he's been in touch with this futurology community, which has all kinds of wildly imaginative ideas about the future. And so he's, during his whole career, he's thrown out a blizzard of very imaginative ideas about how the future ought to be and how the future America ought to be. And you know, during this period, he became a space cadet. I mean, he is the only genuine space cadet I know of in politics today, right? He's a really a believer in, you know, economic exploitation and colonization of space. But, you know, he went to Florida and he had to give a space policy speech in Florida. And, you know, instead of giving a rational, you know, program supporting COTS and continued American manned spaceflight, he went off on this wild tangent about colonizing the moon and admitting the moon as the 51st state. I mean, it's just you know, a classic example of why, you know, Newt cannot be trusted. You know, I mean,
well, you know,
a lot of his ideas are very interesting and provocative, but in terms of practical politics, I mean, he is just...
Okay, so it's one thing for Newt to step in it, but take a look at the response around the country from the general media, from Jon Stewart, from local, you know, TV news shows, local newspapers. I mean, you know, the ridicule, I think it caught a lot of people by surprise.
Well, people in the space cadet community are simply, like, unable to process in their minds the idea that the general population doesn't care about space anymore, right? Because this would conflict with their religious worldview. And, I mean, I wasn't surprised. I mean, you know, I mean, even if it had been a more moderate statement and it hadn't gone off on this lunar statehood tangent, which, of course, would violate international law, even if he did it, I mean, this is the best evidence we have so far, right? The best evidence that the old idea of space as a, you know, a big national crusade supported by the general public is over and dead, right? I mean, you know, I see smart people continuing to promote this idea that we can somehow, if we talk loud enough, turn the clock back to the 60s and have, you know, a big propaganda-oriented, you know, national virility space program. And it's just not true. And, I mean, after this episode, I can't imagine how anybody in their right mind could argue for that. Because, I mean, here a major national political figure laid out the Space Cadet program, the Space Colonization and Exploitation program, and, it, you know, it was treated as evidence of, you know, mental derangement.
You have a caller. You want to go on or take your call?
Sure, I'll take the call.
Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
This is Terry in Corpus Christi.
Go for it, Terry.
Dr. Bell, as long as we were talking about Mars Science Laboratory, what do you personally think are the odds of success? And if this thing fails, what do you think the political repercussions are?
Well, the Mars program is already in trouble, right?
Yeah, it's being canceled.
The major reductions for it were proposed in the president's budget or the OMB budget or whoever actually produces the original phony budget that's submitted to Congress. And I think the problem there is that people are getting tired of Mars. They're getting tired of the same old Mars story that we're looking for life on Mars, and it's very, very important, and we should spend vast amounts of money on it, and we should, you know, starve the rest of the planetary program for it. I mean, this is a joke in the planetary community. I mean, I was discussing this once with a guy, and he said, how many times can they get away with discovering water on Mars over and over again before people notice that nothing new is actually being discovered? And I said, I don't know when that time is, but it's going to come someday. And I think it may have come. I mean, yeah, this is one of the the big government conspiracies in the world today, is that a lot of people have been conned into thinking that their NASA is really searching for life on Mars, and that, you know, it really could be there. Virtually nobody in the astrobiology community actually believes that. The only people who believe that are, you know, a little extreme faction, which happen to be the same people that Elon Musk is planning his Mars, his Red Dragon Mars mission with those people who still believe in, you know, germs on Mars. If you look at what NASA actually says, they say they're, you know, looking for water or other conditions conducive to life. They no longer even say straight out they're looking for life on Mars. And no life detection experiment has been flown to Mars since Viking in 1976.
Well, Curiosity's on its way now.
But it doesn't have any actual life detecting experiments. It's supposed to be looking for fossil life in this alleged sedimentary deposit in this crater. And I've looked at that crater, and I think their scientific advice there is completely bonkers. I mean, those deposits in that crater are clearly wind-deposited deposits and not water-laid sediments, because they're not flat. They form a big hump around the central crater, you know, where there's a dead spot in the wind blowing by. That's exactly where wind-blown deposits would be laid down. The same thing happened with the previous Mars mission, MER. One of the two rovers, Spirit or Opportunity, I can never keep them straight, was sent to this place, Gusev Crater, where they were convinced it had been a lake back in the Clement period on Mars and was full of lake bed sediments. Well, you could just look at a picture of the crater and see a wrinkle ridge running across this formation, right, which is a characteristic formation of basaltic plains. You see them everywhere on the moon. And I asked people if, you know, why are they saying this is sediments when it's obviously a crater has been filled with basaltic lava? Why aren't they going to land there? It's going to look exactly like Hawaii. I could reproduce the results from this mission by, you know, going out to the basalt wall you know, in my neighborhood and taking, and you know, taking off a piece and studying. I mean, there's nothing new is going to be discovered here. Nobody could explain to me who exactly had picked this spot or why they were ignoring the obvious geomorphology that said it was a lava bed. And so they went there, and sure enough, it was a lava bed, and the rovers trundled around for years without finding any sediment. Now, fortunately, they had two missions, and they sent the other one to a spot that was picked on the basis of remote sensing spectroscopic data that was known to have weird minerals present. All right? And there they actually did find weird water-based minerals like sulfates and nitrates. That one was a success. But now they've only had, because this mission is so expensive, they only fly one rover. And they're sending it a place where they're certain not to find what they're looking for, sedimentary rocks that might contain fossils. It's just an example of how bad the planning is for these missions. It all takes place at JPL. It takes place in hermetically sealed rooms. The general science community has no real input into it. There's no peer review panel that reviews Mars missions and compares competing proposals. It's a completely closed shop. And I don't know, this mission might be the one that finally backfires, that, you know, it actually does fail from an engineering point of view. It, you know, it's going to ride around looking for sedimentary rocks and fossils. It's not going to find them. You know, I really think that this this mission, MSL, Curiosity, might be the last Mars mission for a long time. We went through this before when we had the Viking mission, which was specifically designed to search for life, for bugs, germs living in the soil of Mars. We didn't find it. And so for 20 years, we had no Mars program. Because of the big disappointment that that mission caused. I think we may have gone through that cycle again. So we've juiced everybody's hopes up so high that when they're not satisfied, that you know, people might just wise up and decide that Mars is thoroughly explored and it's pretty clear that there's no life there, and that maybe we should, you know, explore some of the rest of the solar system for a change.
Terry Moore?
Just a quick question, and I'll clear the line for someone else. Jim Muncy was on the show yesterday, and he was talking about, instead of SLS, going with something like a Delta IV Heavy with Falcon 9 strap-on boosters, something like that that's nearly into inventory and maybe less expensive and 2 or 3 years to actually get the thing up and flying. What are your thoughts on that? And I'll go ahead and clear the line. Thanks for your being on the show.
Thanks,
you're
Terry.
Splicing together there an old space booster and a new space booster, and I think that would be very complicated. I mean, the real problem with SLS is not, you know, the technical dubiousness of it, the way it's, you know, a rewrite of an already failed program, is that there's no real mission for it, right? I mean, it's, you know, not been decided what this booster will launch or what the mission requirement really is. It's just an attempt by the old space congressman to keep contracts coming to the plants in their districts. It has no rational plan behind it. So, I mean, you'd still have this problem if you, you know, slap together a booster out of existing components rather than, you know,
do it.
And would this really be cheaper and faster than the current program, which, you know, SLS is basically slapping together parts of existing boosters.
Probably not.
Inherits all the old shuttle hardware from 1971. I mean, the real problem here is that, you know, we have not come up with a big manned space mission, you know, for after space station, that really needs to be done.
What should that mission be? Should it be humans to Mars?
I'll tell you what I really think, and I really think that manned spaceflight is finished. That it's reached as far as we can go with current technology, and that it's going to go away in the next 10 or 15 years.
What about the private sector? They seem to be pretty robust on human spaceflight.
But, you know, what are they going to do? All right, how are they going to earn their money if the government isn't, you know, giving them huge grants, right? I mean, and cost plus contracts. They're going to fly a space hotel and fly up a few zillionaires to live in it.
Well, Bigelow Aerospace wants to have his stations up there. That would be accessed by people, researched by other governments. I mean, there's a shot at that.
Yeah, but, you know, that's not what people have in mind. That's what the real space cadet wants. He wants what he saw in NASA reports in the 60s and science fiction in the 50s, right? That's what he wants to see. He wants to see, you know, bases on the moon and Mars and colonization and exploitation, you know. Flying a few millionaires around in orbit, is that really a space program?
So you're saying human spaceflight you think is toast?
Well, I think its time has come and gone. It was created only by a very rare combination of events. You know, it's basically an invention of Nikita Khrushchev. And it was an attempt to puff the Soviet Union up and make it look like it was technologically superior to the United States. And, you know, that worked for a few years, but then we actually started paying attention to space and made it a national priority. And if there hadn't been the Cold War, if there hadn't been the specific challenge from Nikita Khrushchev and the Kremlin, I don't think there would have been an American manned space program then.
Paul's,
maybe not one now.
Paul sent you an email from San Diego, California, and Paul says, Jeff, what would be your ideal program?
Well, I really can't think of one that would make sense. I mean, do we really want to go back to the moon?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, but what's the point, right? I mean, we went there and we found out what we basically already knew, that it was airless and barren and, you know, not of any immediate use. That's the problem, is that people have never succeeded in coming up with a post-Cold War space program. Right? Everything since then has just kind of rolled on inertia.
Well, what about the ideas to someday mine the moon, use it for in-space manufacturing, things like that, even solar power?
Well, I mean, those things are just absurdly expensive, right? I mean, there's just no way they can be done with existing technology. You would require basically free launch in order to make any of those things economically profitable.
There has to be something positive you see for the future of space.
Well, I think the unmanned program will continue to produce brilliant results. I mean, we really are exploring the solar system. We really are doing all those things that people wanted to do back in the 50s and the 60s.
But they want to do it with people, not with robots.
Well, that's not how things are done nowadays. We've gone beyond that, right? Let's suppose you wanted to make a map of some place in Antarctica or Siberia or Devon Island, to choose in a remote site, right?
Right.
Would you send a team of surveyors to Devon Island with transits and have them survey the island?
No.
No. It's all done by satellite. It's been done by satellite years ago.
I mean, I'd turn on Google Earth, first of all.
Well, right.
And see if it's on Google Earth.
You know, I mean, this is the era of the Internet, the age of cybernetics, right? I mean, we do everything by remote control. You know, we don't actually go out and explore places, right? It's all done by satellite photography, right? And that's the way to explore Mars and the moon, if we still want to explore it, right, is to do it robotically. That program is a big success. The manned program running in parallel has been nothing but a series of failures, right? Isn't it time that we took the old staff college recommendation that is taught in every military school in the world, is to star failure and reinforce success?
It is such a, you know, even if we go outside the cadet family, I think that it would be a really hard pill to swallow. I can't think of any member of Congress who would want to shut down human spaceflight on their watch.
Yeah, that's the difficult part. Once the program has been going for a long time and people just kind of accept it as part of the government, it's tough to shut it down. You have to do it obliquely.
Well, I don't want to do it at all. So,
but you have to come up with, I mean, and I've tried this for years, and I've failed.
You have to come up with a reason for doing it.
Come up with a reason to spend a lot of money. And a lot of money means maybe twice the current NASA budget, which is what it would take to do all these things that people want to do, right? And this was rejected back as early as 1971, the Agnew Commission report. I mean,
well, what if we pare the list down of all the things we want to do, and we look at one or two really high valuable, high return things that human space flight contributes to. So, a lot of the medical research. Let's just take the bone loss and microgravity is having amazing impact on treating osteoporosis here on Earth, and we couldn't get a lot of that information without the microgravity portion of it. I mean, it's really huge. Is it worth, you know, the multi billions that we spend for it? Well, if you're the one with osteoporosis, obviously it's worth it, or if it's your mother or your grandmother. But I guess that's an issue, you know, that gets answered somehow, you know, in whatever processes are used in a democratic society. But so the medical side of what we learn and do by living in space is really huge.
I've heard that claim many times, but when you try to look for details, yeah, I just don't see them. I mean, are there really any medical advances that wouldn't have been made otherwise?
Well, the whole
doing research. I mean, this whole spinoff idea has always bothered me because, you know, if you want to find a cure for cancer, you go find a cure for cancer. You don't wait for it to come out by accident from some other program.
Well, again, I'll point to another one, you know, which I'm very close to because of cystic fibrosis. So by being able to do protein crystal growth in low orbit, and they were able to spread that genetic complex apart and understand how it works. And now they actually have the first targeted ever genetic drug that reverses the effect of a genetic defect. Now, it's for a small mutation among the CF family, but all of this is coming from what was done on the space station with liquid protein, with the crystal protein growth, with the CF cells. So, again, how do you value it? And could it be done robotically only? I don't know that answer. Maybe it could have been done robotically early.
Medical research community, pay for this work, all right? Or will they only take it if NASA pays for it, all right?
Well, who pays for medical research here on Earth? They get grants from, you know, the different government organizations and the different foundations and things. The researchers aren't paying it out of their own pocket.
No,
but, you know, they're getting federal money.
NIH is.
You know, which is federal
NIH
money.
To decide, you know, where they get the most bang for the buck. And if they were actually charged the cost of sending people up to the space station and running experiments there, the real cost of it, they would never agree to it because it's so much more effective to spend that money on Earth.
Well, once but they
again,
can't get the result
the transit
on
costs, the transit costs are just prohibitive.
But they can't get the results from on Earth that they can get in the low gravity microgravity environment. So again, I guess if you're going to use federal money or foundation money or nonprofit money, obviously they're going to weigh, is this worth the cost, right?
Right.
And I can't tell you how they will vote for that. I mean, obviously, I'm more than happy that this particular research was done because it affects me personally. But, I mean, that's not a reason to do things on a national level. But all of our research is mostly funded now by government, no matter what form or format it's coming out in. Would they, if we had routine space access where we could do this stuff and even the cost of space had come down a little bit, would this be a regular routine venue for medical research? I can't answer that question. I don't know.
There have been several attempts over the years to, you know, privatize the space station, bring in private companies, including medical research companies, to do work there. And they're always very eager at the start, but when they find out what the real costs will be and the kind of safety requirements that NASA levies on any hardware that they would send up, they always drop out. I mean, this has happened like three times since I've been paying attention to the space station. If they had a big program to bring in private industrial research, and it crashes and burns because the NASA system just, you know, isn't adapted to it.
Well, so maybe the key there is to do this on a Bigelow space station.
Yeah, but it's still going to cost you a whole lot to get up there.
Yeah. You have an email from John again in Jersey City, who called in a few minutes ago. Flying a few billionaires, a few foreign astronauts, and a few private research staff to a Bigelow station may not be the space program that many space cadets envisioned, but it gets a sustainable private human space presence into space, and the incremental steps outward become possible from there, even if much slower than we'd all hoped for.
The problem with commercial space flight is that it has to make money. It has to have a return. It can't be like the NASA program, which is just pouring large amounts of tax dollars into a hole for intangible benefit.
Yeah, it has to have a return on investment.
A private commercial space program needs to pay its way, right? And I can see the billionaire hotel in orbit paying its way, at least until the supply of billionaires is exhausted. But, you know, I just can't see the next step, right? I mean, a private space station at L2, a private moon base that pays its way. I mean, how is that going to happen? What is the product going to be? I mean, I know you had many people on the show who argue for these things, but I'm just not convinced.
And they think the market is sufficient, and the price will come down, so you will not just lure in billionaires, but you'll be able to get millionaires and then thousandaires, if that's a word. And so the market will expand as the cost goes down, and so you will have multiple space hotel locations and destinations and a sufficient market to go visit them.
Yeah, well, again, the key point is there, the launch cost will go down by, you know, a factor of 10, a factor of 100, a factor of 1,000, like we've been promised over and over again ever since Space Shuttle, right?
Right.
And somehow it never happened. Because the technology to do that just doesn't exist yet.
Well, SpaceX is trying to reverse that. Are you optimistic?
Well, they're trying to cut things down by like a factor of 5, which, you know, I think is a modest goal and maybe even an achievable goal, especially if they have a cheap means of booster retrieval. But, you know, once again, they had a perfectly sound, cheap concept for booster retrieval, the float-back system. But somehow none of their first stages ever survived to be floated back. So now they've gone on with a wild tangent of adopting the blast-back booster recovery program where, you know, the first stage somehow blasts its way back to Cape Kennedy and lands on a little parking lot.
Okay, here's a challenge for you, okay, from Michael Listener, who's a space attorney. Are you ready for this challenge?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to twist his words around a little bit. But he basically sent in an email, and he said, "I would love to see your guest debate Zubrin, who I understand is your guest tomorrow night. Zubrin would give him some reasons for human spaceflight. So you know Bob Zubrin's arguments very well. And you know he's inspiring.
He has community own personal newt.
Yeah, so he's his own personal newt. Why don't his reasons for Mars Direct and going to Mars resonate with you? What is there about that? Forget the fact that you may think it's not technically doable. Let's just zero out technology and engineering, okay? And look on the inspiring humanity. This really grabs me and I want to do it side of the spectrum. What is there about what Bob says that doesn't connect to you?
Well, I just don't see what the pressing national need is to send people to Mars.
Okay, so let me stop you, because one of the arguments that Bob and others use is that as a culture, you deteriorate and stagnate if you don't continually explore and reach outward. So Mars fulfills that part of the human spirit.
There's never been a time in American history where we've been doing less exploring and reaching outward. I mean, look at the kind of scientific discoveries that are being made.
Well, they're talking about with human reaching out and exploring. For the human spirit, they cite Lewis and Clark all the time. Bob always cites Lewis and Clark.
Well,
or maybe it was Lois and Clark, or is that something different? I've been doing this too many years.
The problem here, and this is why I wouldn't debate Zubrin.
You would not debate Zubrin.
Because it's pointless.
But it would be fun.
Well, it might be fun for the audience, but...
Well, yeah, that's what I mean.
It wouldn't be fun for me or for Zubrin, right? I mean, these things are not settled by debates. They're settled by, you know, what's scientifically, engineeringly, economically possible. And Zubrin's program, it's a 60s program. It would make perfect sense in 1965. NASA had programs very much like his in 1965. Right, you can read about them in old issues of Aviation Week, but it just doesn't make sense today. I mean, what is the point of going to Mars? I mean, he'll give you answers that really don't make any sense. Like Earth might be destroyed, so we have to have a second autonomous civilization on
Mars. Well, aren't you curious? Don't you want to go to Mars and see what's there and just satisfy the basic human. Wondering about
like
what's out
that,
there.
But the way to do that is through unmanned expeditions.
But it's not. There's something really different about a robot, even Robbie the robot, if we sent him to Mars, versus a bunch of people up there walking around. It doesn't resonate with you, does it?
No, it doesn't. I guess because I spent years exploring asteroids remotely, and this is basically a romantic argument you're making, right? I mean, this would sell in the 19th century. You could have sold it to Hitler. You probably could have sold it to any number of communist dictators over the years. But it just doesn't resonate in modern free market capitalist society that, you know, somebody is going to spend billions and billions of dollars for a gesture, for a flag raising, for a romantic thrill that some people have.
I have a survey to tell you about.
Mm-hmm.
Hold on, I'm opening it up. Okay. So this was sent to me by Terry, who called in a little while ago, and he sent it to me yesterday or the day before. And he saw it on the MSN homepage, website, whatever that thing is. So 50 years after John Glenn was launched into space, where should we go next? So the first destination choice was return to the moon. 20% voted return to the moon. It got 36,009 votes. The next question was, how about Mars? The poll got 31% there, and that translated to 56,119 votes. Now, here's the one you're going to love. The third and final question was simply stay at home. 49%, 90,000 279 votes. Now, clearly it's not scientific. We don't know anything about how MSN did the survey or the poll, but that would coincide with what you're talking about.
Yeah, and I bet if you did an age breakdown there, you'd find that most of the people who voted stay at home.
They're all younger people.
They're younger people.
Yeah, right? Mary, people, Dr. Dittmar did that in her...
this anomalous period in the 1960s when, you know, beating the commies to the moon was a major national priority. People who lived through that period, who, you know, watched the coverage, who read the science fiction of that era, you know, they've got that all pre-programmed in their head. I had it pre-programmed in my head. It took me years to break away from it. But people who've grown up since Apollo, you know, they have a totally different view, right? I mean, and I think in terms of the modern age, they're right. I mean, in the 21st century, there's no overwhelming national need to continue on with a space program that, you know, send guys to the moon again or sends people to Mars.
Okay,
I mean, there's just nothing to be gained by it which would justify the huge expense.
So, Jeff, Sally in Las Vegas says, let's assume that Curiosity finds biological life on Mars of some level. Would that, in your opinion, warrant humans on Mars?
Well, if we found biological life, it would be very difficult to send humans, right? Because humans would inevitably contaminate the place with their own bacteria.
Well, they could be sterilized, right? Like our hardware.
Well, think about how to sterilize the outside of a spacesuit and all the tools and everything that somebody would use. How would you sterilize the inside of the airlock that the guy uses to get out? I mean, it's virtually impossible to design a manned Mars mission that wouldn't, you know, vent some air loaded with microbes out onto the surface.
So you don't think finding some kind of life form or molecules or something on Mars would permit a human mission to Mars?
I think there would be a very serious call from people to leave Mars alone and not contaminate it and ruin it.
And what about China or other countries that could care less about this stuff? Wouldn't they just go and launch a mission anyway?
Well, there's nobody else who has the money or the technology to even consider a Mars mission. The idea of the Chinese doing it is ludicrous. I mean, they can't even build a toaster that works. And so I can assure you, from having gone through about 6 toasters in the last 2 years...
Well, but their spacecraft work and their...
But the underlying assumption here is that germs will be discovered on Mars by some mission, right?
Well, that's her model that she's using to ask the question.
Yeah, well, okay, suppose that happens. Uh-huh. Who's going to get excited about it outside of a few space cadets?
Well,
people already know that, you know, life is possible in space. Many people already think that there's life on Mars,
well, so
even that NASA has discovered it.
So then why would we be
doing... about it.
Why would we be doing Kepler missions and other things if none of this matters?
Well, you know, Kepler is the kind of mission that we should be doing more of and better of. And we could if NASA wasn't wasting all this money on a failed manned program.
So you would kill human spaceflight and put all of the turkeys on the robotic and science side?
I think there's really no sensible option to doing that right now. I mean, 50 years have gone by since John Glenn, and we still haven't produced any real major benefit from spaceflight. You know, it's I just think the dream has failed. Outside the small space cadet community, which seems to get smaller all the time, space travel just doesn't have the cachet that it had in the 60s. And that survey you cited certainly makes that case.
John from Jersey City wrote an email. Private research on station hasn't failed entirely. The NanoRax model seems to be working quite well from all accounts. I think that friendlier turnkey research opportunities provided by a commercial middleman like NanoRack, rather than forcing companies through the Byzantine bureaucratic process of dealing directly with NASA, is what is missing.
Yeah. Well, this is a big problem with NASA. And a Bigelow station or any private space station would have a big advantage here because, you know, NASA has developed this gigantic bureaucracy around the space station program, which makes it very, very difficult to get an instrument on there because you have to fill out so many forms and file so many reports that normal academic researchers or normal industrial researchers will just not go through it unless they have some other choice. I mean, we had somebody right here in Hawaii, a friend of mine, was designing a military instrument to go on the space station. And eventually, even the Pentagon gave up trying to, you know, get through the Byzantine NASA procedures for it, and actually designed a spacecraft with a little pressure hull and a window so they could take this instrument, which was designed to work in the space station atmosphere, and fly it on an unmanned mission without having to vacuum rate it. Of course, that spacecraft never actually flew, but it was an interesting commentary on how... Yeah, on how the whole NASA bureaucracy... And they've made these attempts to try to pry the space station out of NASA's hands, right? Declared it a national laboratory, right? Well, and they've picked an organization to run this national laboratory, and they didn't pick any of the established outfits like places that run observatories or the Space Telescope Science Institute, University's Space Research Association... There are several candidates for that, but they didn't pick any established organization. They picked this organization, which apparently consists of two people, and which, you know, has done nothing. You know, they haven't even been able to keep their website up to date. What's it called? CASIS. Right? I mean, NASA's never actually going to give any organization, real organization, control over ISS. I mean, it's an international space station, too, right? So
yeah, it has partners, of course. I mean, you'd have to have consensus or all of them or whatever.
Right.
I don't know.
NASA has to do the negotiation with the European countries and Russia and Japan, right, about operating the station. How could this private national lab organization operate in context of that? It could never really be put in total charge of the station, because NASA is always going to be responsible for the international connections of it, right? This is why I think that a private space station, if it ever exists, would be a much better place to do research than ISS, because, again, it's just too complicated. It's the ultimate, you know, multi-headed hydra in space, not only physically with, modules and parts from different countries interacting with one another, but the bureaucratic interaction between these organizations is just nightmarish.
You have another email, and this is Todd, also in San Diego. And Todd says, if we assume for a minute that you're right, I can't think of anybody who would come forward and propose as policy what you're talking about. So, if you really think that everything is a waste on the human spaceflight side and that all this money should be directed toward the science and the robotic side, how would you implement that given that nobody that I can think of is going to admit to and step forward and say, bah humbug to human spaceflight, let's just kill it and let's do everything on the other side? It'll never happen. Nobody would have the guts to step forward to do it now.
Well, we have this problem right now is that NASA is basically run by a small cabal of congressmen who want to see continued pork pull into their district. And those people certainly would fight tooth and nail against any phase-out of manned spaceflight, just the way they fought against any minor change in... in SLS, right, the Senatorial Launch System. It's a booster that, you know, has no payload, has no goal. It exists only to funnel money into the existing NASA centers and the existing program, existing contractors. So you're right, this is unsellable today. But when the national debt is much worse and we're facing massive cutbacks in things like Social Security and food stamps and defense, the situation might be different.
Do you think that's going to happen, or do you think we're going to get that spending under control? This is a different subject, of course, but I'm curious.
Well, this is part of the problem, and the inability to, you know, control spending at NASA or even predict how things will cost at NASA is just a part of the bigger problem of government spending and our unwillingness to pay taxes. I mean, the problem is that people in America want a European-style social democracy welfare state, but they refuse to pay the taxes necessary to support it. And since everyone is, for some inexplicable reason, willing to buy, you know, unlimited amounts of T-bills, it's very easy for politicians here to, you know, continue spending wildly and exempting all rich people from taxes. Just like in Greece, and our situation is just like Greece, you know, and the rest of the Catholic zone in Europe, which is going broke, because they were able to borrow unlimited amounts of money and allow people to evade taxes and, you know, create a vast welfare state, a vast corrupt, non-functional government. I mean, this is what's happened in Greece and to a lesser extent in Italy and Spain and all the countries that are going broke. We're just a little farther behind because we, you know, the oil sheiks and the Chinese and the people fleeing from Europe with their money are still willing to buy our treasury bonds.
You have another caller. Hang on. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Hi, David. It's Mike Listener.
Hi, Michael.
And before I begin, I'm just let you know I'm being. This is just my opinion. But I really don't agree with you, Doctor. I mean, I think that, you know, there is a significant place for manned spaceflight in our culture and in our time. I mean, excuse me, my cuckoo clock's going off again. It happens every time I make a call for some reason. But anyways, I think there's still a firm place for it. And you talked about China and Russia, you know, not ever setting their sights on places like the Moon and Mars. My question is, if spaceflight is so passe, why are the Chinese investing so much money into manned spaceflight? Why are they planning these large space stations and eventually manned trips to the moon? China's culturally is more practical and more practical than, say, Western society. They take a different viewpoint, and yet they consider manned spaceflight to be important. So if it's so passe, why is China spending all this money to actually put men in space?
Well, China, of course, is the land of faith. Appearance is everything, and reality is secondary. And that hasn't changed just because of the communist period. Well, in the first place, they're not spending very much money on manned space, right? I mean, it's the slowest manned space program in human history. They're now flying a mission roughly every 3 years. And their program right for now is equivalent to the Soviet Salyut station, right? Eventually, when they have their bigger booster running and their new launch site running, they hope to launch a station equivalent to Salyut, which was a lot smaller than Skylab, right? That's their program. And the idea is they're suddenly going to spend the amount of money necessary to develop a Saturn V-like booster and go to the moon, I think is pretty unlikely. The big question is, why are they doing it, right? And they're doing it because we're doing it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we did it is because Russia did it. Mm-hmm. It all traces back to Nikita Khrushchev's brain, right? Once he had this series of space spectaculars and media extravaganzas, having a manned space program and a planetary program and an unmanned lunar program became a big prestige item for every country, right? Mm-hmm. So we had to do it. Europe had to do it. Japan had to do it. India has to do it, and China has to do it, right? You have to do it in order to be perceived as a major world power, right? So the interesting question is, what would happen if we stopped doing it as the leading world megapower that everybody models themselves after? That's an interesting question. I'm not clear that anybody would continue to do it.
Don't you see it as a technology leader, a superpower leader? If we retreated and pulled out of it, don't you think these other nations would plow ahead for the benefits they get out of it?
Well, I mean, what benefits do they get out of it? China, again, is doing it as strictly a propaganda exercise. I mean, the current program started.
I disagree with that. I don't think it's a propaganda exercise. I think they recognize the value that a manned space program has, and like you said, prestige, and in being viewed as a world leader, because it not only helps them in developing their own technology base, but it also helps them in the geopolitical realm as well. I'm of the opinion, and I'm a pretty practical guy. You know, I have goals and I have desires to where I would like to see a space program go, but I'm a pretty practical guy. But at the same time, I understand the value that a program has, and if we suddenly drop out of it, I think others like Russia and China will rush to fill that void and move forward.
Yeah, I just find it very difficult to imagine how they would do that. I mean, certainly Russia, I mean, they're operating completely on the remnants of the Soviet program, and I just don't see them, unless they had a major economic revival there after Putin is thrown out. But, you know, who knows when that'll happen.
I think it's an assumption to think that, you know, it's pretty much follow the leader here, because I think other cultures, well, Russia understands the importance. Hell, heck, they wouldn't have been, you know, they wouldn't have stopped manufacturing launchers. Granted, I mean, the Soyuz technology is very mature, but that doesn't mean it's obsolete, and that doesn't mean it isn't workable. The same thing with Constellation. Yes, it was kind of Apollo Redux, but the technology worked. And if you can improve on the technology, and if it still works, you don't throw it out. I just don't think it's a logical argument to say just because this is 60s and 70s technology or thinking means it's wrong.
Oh, I don't say that at all. I mean, the technology developed in the 60s is the right technology, as we discovered when we tried to go beyond it with the space shuttle. Right? There's nothing wrong with the basic concept behind Orion. The Ares boosters had some serious technical problems. I mean, you got perfectly right there. It's the basic technology of spaceflight has not changed since 1970 and probably won't change for a long time. And that's one of the reasons why the idea that space is, you know, symbolic of technical leadership or drags our technology ahead is wrong. I mean, that's never really been true. NASA has never been a source of new technology. Everything they did, even in the 60s, was derived from existing military programs, usually highly classified programs that we knew nothing about at the time. I mean, a while back, the previous NASA administrator actually said it, that, you know, NASA is no longer in the technology development business, if it ever was, and that was his excuse for using what people perceive as obsolete technology in the Constellation program. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at the Chinese program. It's entirely based on Soviet technology, right? Mm-hmm. They purchased it all from the Russians. On their spacewalk a while back, one guy was using a Chinese copy of a Russian spacesuit, but the guy who stayed inside would go out to rescue him was wearing an actual Russian spacesuit, which they had just bought from the Russian Space Agency. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is an idea that holds over from the 60s and has a grip on the minds of older people who lived through that period, is that space is a high-technology business. Well, That's not really true. Certainly today, it involves basically low technology.
As somebody who was in diapers and basically born in the same year that Apollo 11 landed on the moon, I can't really say my mind is. I can't say that my mind was gripped by it during that time period, even though I was fascinated with it. But I think even rationally thinking as a professional and as an educated individual, I see value in continuing a manned space program for not just for the political pride. That was the biggest problem with Apollo. We were so concerned about the political aspects of it, we didn't think about the scientific and the actual advancements that could have come out of continuing Apollo. It was too political, and I think that's our problem, is we're basing this too much on politics and not sitting down and saying, look, we got something. Space is something we can utilize. Let's work it from that end. And we can get into the commercial argument. We could argue for a long time and probably disagree on it. But again, if we can make space accessible, which companies like SpaceX are working on, and if we can get organizations like NASA to lessen the bureaucratic load, to let these people operate, and again, there's some legal issues as well that have to be dealt with, I think you might see the investment money start to trickle out and actually be interested in investing in these new technologies and these new techniques to actually promote these ventures.
Well, that's just the standard new space line, and I would be glad to see it come true. But so far, I don't see much sign of it actually happening. I mean,
mm-hmm.
But again, that's a separate issue from the idea that we should maintain a huge government-based civilian space program inside NASA, right?
Well, we gotta have some sort of control in some respect, because, I mean, under the Outer Space Treaty, we're required to oversee any activities outside of that are even non-governmental in nature. You need some sort of organization like NASA to oversee.
Well, the FAA
you can't get away from that. You can't get away from that.
That function is allocated to the FAA and not to NASA.
Well, for actual activities, FAA only goes to the point of actually launching the vehicle, whereas when it gets up in space, really NASA and some of the other organizations are involved as well, like NOAA and organizations like that. I think FAA is only primarily concerned with the actual launch vehicle itself, not the actual vehicle that's going to be performing activities in outer space.
As far as I know, NASA has no regulatory oversight of space vehicles at all, private space vehicles.
Mm-hmm. That is true, and the AST regulates launch and return and some environmental components of that, because you have to have an environmental impact report to do it. But at this point, this is a big bone of contention among different divisions within the industry, there is absolutely zero traffic management regulations. And so one arm calls for traffic management, and another arm says, no, leave us alone. We can handle this. We don't need any regulation. But there has never been more than one vehicle that has been able to go to the space station at a time. And the same with docking and rendezvousing. And if space were really populated with commercial enterprise, there would absolutely need to be rules of the road and traffic management and docking and rendezvous rules and things like that, especially if you had depots and other vehicles up there. But today it's absent, and today there's no volume of traffic warranting it.
If that great day ever comes, then logically Air Force Space Command would do it, because they monitor everything.
Well, they're calling for rules of the road.
And they supply warnings to commercial spacecraft operators today so that they can avoid collisions.
Yeah, and they're actually among the groups that calls for rules of the road. In fact, the European voluntary code of behavior had rules of the road and some traffic management provisions in it. And that is part of why the Air Force supported it, but lots of other groups were not supportive of it because they thought it would give the Air Force too much authority and would be anti-commercial space development, because most of the new space commercial space people don't think there's a need for traffic management. I did a show on Propellant Depot. It was either last, yeah, I think it was last year, and there was a huge argument on that show about the need to have traffic management going to a depot. And the new space side of this was you don't need traffic management. The traffic will take care of itself. And the guys who have actually done rendezvous and docking, who were the guests on the show, and have actually flown these missions when you rendezvous and dock, just said, you know, basically, you don't know what you're talking about because, you know, we don't know how to rendezvous and dock multiple spaceships. It's not like Moonraker where, you know, all the shuttles are going up there and docking in port 1, 2, 3, and 4. And yeah, and how you talking. Get there and orbit to get there. And absolutely, they said that there will be an evolution of traffic management, rules of the road, regulations, when and if this industry ever develops like that.
Well, yeah, I think it might be better to have a civilian agency doing it rather than
space.
Because they already do too much, like, you know, running GPS. We haven't talked about the light squared. Yeah.
Well, it's over with. The FAA, and we're about out of the time for the show, but it's been cooked. The goose is put back in the can, and it's the FAA said no way.
Yeah.
And I don't...
A major Obama campaign contributor wants it to go forward.
Well, as
so
they
say... You'll still see continuous pressure to authorize the system, which will jam GPS. I mean, I first read about this. I couldn't believe it. Why would anyone in their right mind propose a system that might interfere with GPS or any other existing system, right? It's on the burden of the new program to not interfere with the existing program. But, you know, because a big billionaire who sent a lot of money to Obama's campaign was behind it, the latest scandal on that is that the general, Air Force general in charge of Space Command, admitted that the Obama White House tried to get him to change his testimony to Congress over light squared to indicate that it wouldn't actually jam GPS.
Well, obviously, when they started doing the test, there's a problem with it. So,
yeah, well, it's a part of the modern world is that a lot of people involved in the technology don't understand it, and they don't understand, you know, that when the laws of physics say something, you can't get around it by making political contributions or putting out lots of press releases. The press releases that LightSquared put out about this issue were just wonderfully entertaining because they were, you know, completely irrelevant to the technical issues involved. I don't think anybody in their PR department understood the least thing about GPS or how important it was and how crazy their proposal was.
Michael, are you still on?
I'm still here, and I really don't have anything else to add, but it was a pleasure speaking with you, sir. Even though we disagree on many things, I'm sure, it's always good to hear somebody else's opinion out there.
Thanks.
Well, I like to hear ardent space cadets arguing with me about this because it helps me modify and consolidate my own thinking about it. I tell you that I used to be a fanatic space cadet, just like you. You know, I was a member of the L5 Society. And it's taken me a long time to, you know, admit that...
You went to rehab, right?
Well, I thought of writing an article about how to go through space cadet withdrawal.
Space cadet rehab.
It's been tough for me, and I know it's tough for a lot of other people, too. But I still enjoy talking with people who still have the faith.
I would still love you to see. Still love to hear you and Bob Zubrin go out.
Well, you ought to call in tomorrow.
I agree, Dave. With David, it would be entertaining.
You ought to call in tomorrow when Bob is on the phone. It'll be still early for you in Hawaii.
Okay, if I'm from around, I'll make sure to give a call in then.
All right, bye bye.
All right.
Jeff, I think you ought to set up a space cadet rehab facility on the Big Island. You'd make a ton of money. The people would come there. You know, they'd go through withdrawal and with beautiful Hawaiian ocean water, coconuts, dancing girls, hula. You'd indoctrinate them into real reality and send them back after a month of being in Hawaii. This would be a new business for you. And you would be the head doctor planning the rehab programs for space cadets.
Yeah, well, It's virtually impossible.
You could start with
business in Hawaii.
You could start with the Hawaii division there that wants to have a big space program in Hawaii that I always get their emails on.
Oh, the Hawaii Space Flight Laboratory?
Not the laboratory, no. I get the emails about the spaceport and other activities that Hawaii is doing on the commercial private side from different groups that always talk about the progress that's coming from Hawaii.
Yeah, well, Hawaii spaceport has been proposed on and off for many years, and it'll never happen.
Next time I get an email from all of these, I'll forward it to you.
Yeah. Well, we had a period here in Hawaii, which I referred to as the Great South Sea Space Bubble. There was wild promotion of the idea of a spaceport here in Hawaii. And there was actually an Office of Space Industry set up, and a former admiral inevitably was hired to be in charge of it, and they were going to set up a spaceport on the south point of Big Island, and it all collapsed in a heap of rubble when first almost every interest group and pressure group on the Big Island opposed it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, any kind of technological innovation or innovation of any kind is just reflexively opposed by a big element of the population here in Hawaii. I mean, a lot of the politically active people here are former hippies who left California because it was too socially restrictive and moved out here. And the Big Island is just full of these people. You know, they live out in the woods and grow their own marijuana, and their houses are wired for 6 volts, and they, you know, have windmills and solar panels keeping them alive. And they're just reflexively opposed to anything involved in technology. I mean, who is it wants to build a spaceport here now? Elon Musk has mentioned it.
I don't know. I'm not up on that. But the next time I get their email, I'll forward it to you and let you see what I'm talking about.
Well, the previous spaceport bubble, the Great South Sea Space Bubble, collapsed when it was discovered that the admiral in charge of the Office of Space Industry was on two different payrolls. He was drawing a huge amount of money from the state of Hawaii for selecting a spaceport, and he was also getting huge consulting fees from Lockheed Martin to pick them to operate the spaceport. And even in Hawaii, that was unacceptable, so he went away, and I think Office of Space Industry went away or has a different name now. It was. This was the same time when every state was developing a spaceport. Florida, California, Alaska actually did develop a spaceport on Kodiak Island.
Well, they have one and they use it, and
it's very, very seldom used.
What? How do you want to wrap up the show? We're a little beyond 2 hours, so I guess we should bring us to a close. So, what would be your pearls of wisdom or your closing comments?
Well, I don't know what to say. I mean,
you said enough to make everybody mad. So.
I would still like to see a space program. I would like to see people walking around on Mars. You know, I would like to see colonies in the asteroid belt. I would like to see all this, but you know, just because some people are entertained or interested in it doesn't mean that huge amounts of public money should be spent on it. And this is the problem we have is that, I mean, that poll that you cited where, you know, 49% of the respondents didn't want to go anywhere in space pretty much tells the story.
It's not scientific. I mean, how we can't really rely on it that much. But
well, you'd think that people who supported space and wanted to go to the moon or Mars would be encouraged to, you know, vote in the poll. I mean,
well, they'd have to know.
49% of the people would bother respond. Who were interested in space?
Well, they'd have
didn't
to
want to go anywhere. Would bother responding to the poll?
Well, but you, I didn't know the poll was there. So, I mean, that's part of the problem is how many people, space cadet or otherwise, knew that MSN was running a poll on their website.
Periodically, there are control polls done by Gallup and similar organizations that have a standardized set of questions about outer space,
and they're comparable.
The numbers, the support numbers, have been declining for 20 or 30 years. You know, I mean, the space cadet community is increasingly unrepresentative of what the average person thinks.
When what's her name? God, I said it a little while ago. I can't believe Dr. Dittmar did her classic study about 5 years ago on Gen Y students in Mars, and the, you know, I have it in previous shows that I've done, and also I have her report. But the vast majority of this young group of people had zero interest in going to Mars. I mean, the vast majority. You can probably get the report on Google. Just search Dr. Dittmar and Mars Survey or Mars Youth Survey or something like that. I was stunned, and that was a scientific poll. Didn't want to go to Mars, had no desire.
Yeah, the real numbers are much worse than in that poll you cited, I think. I mean, control polls, and the trend is what really concerns me, is that, you know, interest in space has gone down, you know, ever since the Apollo era. And I really think it only survives because of pork barrel politics and bureaucratic inertia in the government. I mean, if we were to start a new manned space program today, you know, without the impetus of Khrushchev and the Cold War threat, I don't think it would get off the ground. You know, I don't think that, you know, any president could get it through Congress.
Closing comments. Give me something positive to go with.
Well, I'm still hopeful that the new space community, or the parts of it that are less crazy than some, will make a significant decrease in launch costs. I think if SpaceX gets its act together and continues to get some level of funding from the Air Force and from NASA, that, you know, they might manage to do it. I hope that this gap of a year in their test program is just a glitch or a political thing, as someone suggested. I still think that, you know, we might have cheaper commercial spaceflight. I haven't given up on that.
That would be a game changer.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but and I guess the reason I hope that is because I've pretty much given up on the official NASA program being able to produce anything. I mean, the new Constellation 2.0 program is, it's just so pitiful that it's one of those programs that you can tell right from the start it's not going to go anywhere. Got no goals and no particular aims except to keep people employed in certain districts, and I just don't see how a program like that can survive in the long term.
Well, a lot of it will probably be canceled over the next couple of years unless something happens to really rev up the economy, and I don't see that happening. But something could happen to rev up the economy. I don't say it's impossible, but not likely.
I'm not sure that economic growth or recovery has much to do with this, except for the possibility that, you know, we'll eventually have to get the government debt under control. That's the long-term threat to this and a lot of other government programs that aren't meeting a serious national need.
Is the national debt.
Yeah, well, you can just see what's going to happen by looking over at Europe. They have a special problem there because of that insane common currency, but the basic point is there's just a point at which you can pile up debt, and you can't go beyond that.
Jeff, until the next time, we will do this again if we're not blackballed from the space cadet world after today's program. But if I were drinking with you and toasting with you, I would say to better days. How about that?
Yeah, I still think there may be better days for for spaceflight, but I'm just a little bit scared about how many times SpaceX has been mentioned in this program. You know, if we've reached the point where everybody's hopes are placed on one company, one startup company.
That is a risk.
You know, that's a little scary. I would be happier if there were two or three companies that were doing SpaceX comparable stuff. You know, there are other companies in the COTS program and other millionaires that are funding their own programs, but I don't see one that's really operating at the level that SpaceX is.
Well, we talked about this with Muncie yesterday, and you know, they may end up selecting in the next COTS program a one company option, and they need two or three. They need the Boeing, they need SpaceX, they need the companies. We must have more than one if we're going to have a serious program.
Well, I think that may be true at the development level. I'm not sure that we can really afford to have two companies flying Americans up to the space station. You know, this is what happened with the EELV program, right? Is that originally they were going to develop Delta and Atlas, and there were going to be two boosters, and they'd be down selected for production, right? The best one would actually go into production, and all military missions and most commercial missions would ride on different variants of the winning booster. Well, that didn't happen for reasons of political pork. The Air Force was forced to select them both for production and go into production at, you know, the two different locations. And Lockheed Martin and Boeing both got their share of the pie. Well, that was when they thought there would be, you know, hundreds of these low Earth orbit commsats would need to be launched, and there would be a huge commercial market for them.
Didn't happen.
The launch rate and production rate for both those vehicles is, you know, really below the efficient rate. You know, I've been expecting one of them to be axed by the Air Force for a long time.
All right, we need to close her down. We're coming up on 2.5 hours, so it's about at the maximum point for a show. Until the next time, my friend, okay?
Okay.
And I appreciate your being here, and we'll talk to you down the road in a couple of months and see if you've donned your space cadet medals again and you're back in the flock. After the after SpaceX has their flight, okay?
Yeah, I'm waiting eagerly for that.
Well, probably April or May. So maybe in the summer we'll get together again, and we'll let you critique it all for us. Until then, do you go surfing?
No, I avoid the beach at all times. In fact, I usually do not go outdoors between 9 and 3.
God, you might as well move to North Dakota.
Well, it's still very pleasant here on cloudy days.
Well, I know it's very pleasant in Hawaii, but if you're not out there in the water...
It's also the world capital of skin cancer, which is why I avoid the sun as much as possible.
Well...
I have friends who've had, like, several tumors removed just on the parts of their bodies that are visible.
See, space is going to find an answer to this. Wait and see.
Yeah, space will answer all our problems.
Thank you, Jeff.
Our space program will give every child a pony.
A rocket. To hell with a pony.
A rocket in every pot.
That's 1800s technology. They're going to have a mini Saturn V.
Yeah, if only Newt were president, all these will happen.
Until later in the summer and after the SpaceX flight, when we talk again, thank you again for being on the show. And listeners, remember, Dr. Zubrin is our guest tomorrow night, 7 p.m. California time. Thank you all for being with us today on The Space Show.